Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Mark Bigney. How are you today,
Mark? I'm very well, Walker. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. First episode of the new year. Looking forward to some big, you know, end of the year lists being formed.
Absolutely.
Been seeing some. So much. They're all very different. Usually, you know, you have the same suspects, but this year, everyone is all over the place, which I love.
You enjoy the chaos?
I do.
You want to live in the disorder? Fair enough.
All right. First things first, we're going to talk about the games we played last week. Then we're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Arborea. Mark, what did you play last week?
I played another game of Evolution Climate. Evolution Climate is the standalone pseudo-sequel to Evolution by Dominic Krepchet, Dimitri Nore, and Sergei Machin. This was published by Northstar Games in 2016. I don't have any experience with the original version, nor do I have any other experience with the follow-ons. So keep in mind that the Evolution series is now long-running and with many iterations, but this is the only one that I've played. And it, like many other games of its era, was a tableau builder in which there's a sea of cards and you're expected to navigate what's going on. But here, what you're doing is you're crafting a custom species with various traits, with quite excellent artwork depicting the various traits, adapting to your food needs, your climate needs, and the possibility of predation. And the overall, my experience with Evolution Climate is that it's fine. As a super light tableau builder, it's okay. The problem is that it's really trying to strain the simple tableau builder formula too far. Because when you have a huge deck that is not organized or structured or stratified or divided or staggered in any way, generally speaking, as I've commented before, you really need to have incredible design and development chops to be able to pull that off. Examples that come to mind include Race for the Galaxy and other games by Tom Lehman. He really knows what he's doing. This was one of my problems with Ark Nova, the animal that comes out has prerequisites that are impossible to meet. This is my problem with a number of games where a tableau gets clogged and it's just not at all, nothing at all interesting is coming up. This is a related problem for not only tableau builders, but the Dune Imperium game comes to mind. And with Evolution Climate, there are a whole bunch of subsystems that are potentially interesting that have a whole bunch of rules follow-ons that only seem to work if the cards come out in the proper order. I'm referring specifically to being a carnivore, because if anybody turns carnivore, they're suddenly playing a different game. And the threat of being predated on by a carnivore drives a lot of the potential tension. But in order to be a carnivore, it's the thorniest rules issue, it's nested with the most conditionals, and it depends on the right cards coming up at the right time. And all these things collectively, I think, are one of the key problems of Evolution Climate. It is rendered interesting by the possibility of predation, otherwise you're engaged in a relatively boring game of multiplayer solitaire with a relatively superficial element of hand management. But in order to be a predator, the things have to align in such a way, and suddenly everyone now is more at the mercy of the card deck than they were before.
That's what I mean, because don't you just attack other dinosaurs, and then if...
Well, they're not dinosaurs, Walker, unfortunately. Sorry. They're all manner of different species.
All right, so you attack other animals.
Yes.
And then there are keywords that will stop you from attacking certain animals. And
yes.
And if some players just were lucky enough to get cards that get those keywords, then you're just going to target the ones that don't have. So those, the people that didn't get the right cards, are now going to be targeted.
Precisely.
Oof.
And it is often the case that the moment a predator shows up, a lot of people, either because they're being too conservative or because it's the right play, sometimes a mixture of both, end up just lording on a whole bunch of defensive traits onto their animal. They're still winning, but they're winning in a boring and uninteresting way, because every trait that's on a surviving animal is worth a point at the end of the game. So that carnivore that's desperately trying to predate on people is, you know, trying to catch up. in terms of being able to leverage its abilities. And yeah, it's going to get points from its traits as well. But it's this bizarre arms race that leads to stagnation in an unsatisfying way. It makes me feel like if Amabel Holland were designing this game, she'd have attached it to some sort of incredibly politically, socially, or historical relevant theme, so at least you'd be getting something out of it. But, you know, generally I don't find stalemates interesting. That was a strange analogy, but I stand by it. So Evolution Climate is fine, it's quick, it's fast-moving, it's got cute pictures, you get to have a fatty, tissued turtle that's crepuscular, and that's kind of neat, and that's all fun. That's all fine. But ultimately, I feel that that there are thorny rules issues, just in the sense that it's this sort of grafted on element of more complexity on a very, very simple game. Not that it's particularly burdensome, but nonetheless, there it is. That leads to a weird game state that then just exacerbates issues with luck of the draw. So I really respect what Evolution Climate is trying to do. And if somebody were to propose playing some of its follow-ups or even the progenitor, because I think that if you just removed some of the subsystems, that would lessen the impact of the luck of the draw. Because again, you've got this one deck that is meant to satisfy a whole variety of different game states. And I don't know that it can really pull that off. So I enjoyed my time with Evolution Climate. It was fine. But I don't think I'll be seeking it out again. That is Evolution Climate by North Star Games.
I put all my duds first, Mark, because I want to get them out of the way.
All right.
Well, we have Tiny Epic Crimes, Mark. You know, we have a...
Oh, very... Tiny Epic Delusion strikes again.
Yeah, I thought, you know, maybe this time. This is also designed by Scott Ohms and published by Gamelink Games. And this is some sort of weird Guess Who Clue type game. So there's this... deck of suspects that's about 30 or so. And they have the same back. And on the other side, it's that red sort of blotchy ink thing. So you use the funky lens of red and you get to see all sorts of things. You get to see who it is. You get to see the weapon they used. You get to see the vehicle they used. And you get to see what gang they're in and their sort of level in the gang. And there's not a ton of different variety here. You have this card that has all of the suspects on it. So it's like, oh, does your suspect have a gun? No. And then, so that's like half of the people gone because it's either, you know, only three different things. And so now you're moving around, you're using that Red November sort of time track thing where you're moving around this 5x5 grid and you're doing actions that also cost time. And so you're moving down the track and whoever's furthest back on the track will go next. And so you can get multiple turns if you're doing little tiny things. Now the multiple problems.
Isn't everyone doing a little tiny thing?
Yeah, it's true. So all of that so far is the positives. Like those cards are cool. It has a chance because you're going to pick one of those suspects out and they go in the murder envelope.
The murder envelope.
And then for all of those different traits that I talked about, there are separate envelopes that just have a red little window in the right spot. So like when you do the thing on the map that lets you look that up, you take the murder envelope and the other fancy envelope and you switch the cards and they'll show you for the murderer what that trait is.
Question, when playing this game and seeking to identify the gang affiliation of various criminals, were you worried that the Bloods were going to come after you because everything was swathed in red?
Yes.
Okay.
I was more scared of the Crips though.
Okay.
All right. Then you get into the problems because it's a lot, not only a lot, almost all of it is people working towards something. Then whoever finishes gets the benefit. There are things at the top that you can do at night, things along the side that you can do during the day because the time track switches from day to night. It's like, oh, there's these three steps, but whoever does the last step actually gets to see the thing. Everybody else gets, you know, such a minor Benny that's pointless. Mm. So there's those two things, plus there's all these tokens on the map that are the same thing. Only the person that gets the last one gets the benefit, and that's so aggravating. Never mind the fact that our game broke, unfortunately, because when someone was switching the card with the envelope, they accidentally put one of their other suspects in.
Ah.
So our murderer got switched at the end, but that's luckily it was at the very, very end, so two of us still knew who the murderer was, so it's sort of finished. And that was the other huge problem, Marky. It's got this huge time track. And even though you already know who it is, you don't get to end the game.
Really?
You have to keep playing right to the end because you have this player board that every time you get one of those tokens I was talking about, you move up this sort of like police track. And then when you get to the last sort of row of the time track, that's when everyone gets to make their accusation. And whoever is highest on their little police track is going to be the winner.
Huh. I mean, at least that satisfies some of the standards of the mystery genre. You know, the less so the police procedurals, but more the mystery genre, where the ace detective knows the answer about halfway through the story and then just has everyone dancing along to their tune. But that does not sound like an ideal arc for a game.
All of it was very painful. And there's some problems with the cards, because like I said, there's those little envelopes that you're constantly switching the cards between, and they're very tight. So there's already been stories of cards being sort of nicked or damaged.
Oh.
So as soon as one gets done, then you know who that person is.
Yes.
And then you'll see them.
Well, that's what happens when you use murder envelopes.
Yes.
Cards are not going to survive encounters with the murder envelope.
It's true. And that is all I'm going to say about Tiny Epic Crimes. I think I'm just going to stop with Tiny Epic Games. They're doing a Game of Thrones one next, and I'm not even going to... Not that I looked into any others, but
right.
I'm done.
Reasonable.
All right, so the next game, Mark. Well, it's a dud that we both played. At first, I didn't think it was that much of a dud, but upon the second game and reflection, and I played another game by the same designer, I played both The Fox Experiment and Undergrove. And I feel as though they both fail in the same way. There's no sort of build up. You're just doing the same thing over and over again. And then the next time you play, you just sort of slide in and start doing that same thing again.
Yes.
There's hardly any variability. In The Fox Experiment, you're just rolling dice and checking off boxes.
Yeah.
Rolling dice, checking off boxes.
So The Fox Experiment, which I have played, I have not played Undergrove. I agree entirely. The first couple of rounds I thought were kind of interesting, especially because the crucial time ratio of the interesting bits to the non-interesting bits was favorable. The interesting bits are the drafting. It's one of those areas where you can really start to identify what are the pressure points, what are the priorities, what can I wait on? You know, like a quality drafting game or a quality worker placement game where you can look at what other people have and say, okay, that, although I need it the most, they're not going to take it from me, so I can leave that until later.
Yeah, that's what I said last week. That I love that drafting method. We've played multiple games that have that sort of thing.
Yeah, the drafting is great.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, it then proceeds to just the dice rolling, which is purely mechanistic almost, very, very little decision making, very mechanically involved in a physical way, not necessarily in an intellectual way, and it just gets longer and longer and longer as the game proceeds. And in the first two rounds, you kind of don't notice because it's novel and you're doing it the least. But then as the rounds keep going, yeah, you're getting upgrades, but the upgrades just make things worse because you're just taking longer going through the motions. And what's more is that it's not so much variability, I would just say novelty, because there's this conceptually interesting idea of using the foxes that you bred in round one as the parents for the breeding stock of round two. But that doesn't really change anything substantially. Like, there's no particular interest in terms of, oh, well, this is the fox that I bred from last round or the one that Walker bred from last round versus the ones that come off the top of the deck. I mean, yeah, you get to name them. Other than that, So I agree with you. Fox Experiment outlasts its welcome and is utterly repetitive, and it doesn't lean into its strengths. And so the first half of the game, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And then the last half of the game, I'm like, when is this going to end? And I have no difficulty imagining, although it was I've only played it the once, that, you know, round one of my next game could easily feel like round seven of a one game that just never stopped.
That is what it felt like. As, yeah. If you go back and listen to me, I was semi up on The Fox Experiment. Like I
yeah.
said, it was very, like you just said, I want to repeat it again. It was novel. It was interesting. It was something different. And then it's just more of the same.
And look, I understand it. Escalation is hard to do. I mean, there's the old joke about what bad role-playing looks like. It's like, okay, well, when you're level one, you're just making rolls against some target. And, oh, well, later on, you're going to be level two. And then you get a plus one against a target of one higher. It's like, all right, but that's not escalation. That's a fake sense of escalation. And the same thing happens in The Fox Experiment. The numbers get higher, but you're not doing anything different. It's all just the same.
And that is Fox Experiment, designed by Elizabeth Hargrave and Jeff Fraser, and put out by Pandasaurus Games. The next one is Undergrove. It's a mushroom game, also by Elizabeth Hargrave, but also co-designed by Mark Wooten. And this one is put out by AEG. And in this one, much the same. You just have the same actions that you're sort of doing over and over again. Some you can't do because you don't have the right resources, but you're putting out mushrooms and sort of vines out onto all these action spaces. You're sort of as a group building this grid, and you're collecting the carbon, which turns your seedlings into trees, and all the mushrooms are all the cards that you're putting out. So you're either doing an action on the cards to get the resources that will allow you to put out other things, and then you just keep doing the same thing over and over again. I'm wondering, I played it on Board Game Arena, so I'm wondering if I play it in with a physical copy, would it change it? I'm not sure. I very much lost interest quickly.
Yeah, we talked about Undergrove about 5 seconds ago on Pledge of Indifference, so I assumed you were playing it online.
Yes. Yeah. It was, I don't even know what to say. I'm going to read the rule book, because, you know, it was one of these things that was easily picked up. It was like, okay, all of these actions are available because I have the right resources. I can see how that, if I spent the resources, I'd get them back in this way, and then the game progressed. So I'm going to read the actual rule book to see if there's any way to, you know, make it more interesting.
And that's disappointing. I had mild hopes for Undergrove.
That's Undergrove.
Well, you had a couple of duds. I had a couple of historically themed winners. I'm going to start with Votes for Women. This is a game that we've played before in the past, designed by Tori Brown. This is the second published design by Fourth Circle Games, which is very much a publisher to look out for after Shores of Tripoli. Their follow-up is going to be, appropriately enough, The Halls of Montezuma. And Votes for Women is a two-player, highly asymmetric, card-driven historical game about the passage of the 18th Amendment to the United States of America, recognizing women's suffrage. And I really felt the asymmetry this time in Votes for Women. So I got to play the happy fun time side of the opposition. I didn't feel great about that. And the game as it goes on, the power of the suffragist side ramps up considerably. It starts to spiral into this wild concatenating series of amazing card plays, which is appropriate because the burden that they have to clear is huge because they're trying to pass a constitutional amendment. And so there was a little skirmish about the Congress in the start of the game. The suffragists won that, and then we were off to the races trying to fight over the states. And as the opposition, you only need to win 13 states to prevent two-thirds majority in order to pass the amendment. Historically, it was a bit weird. We had the 15th Amendment before the Civil War, which for any Reconstruction buffs out there is a little bizarre. But nonetheless, it's just how it shook out. You know, one of the great things about historically driven CDGs is you can get some kind of pseudo-comprehensible narrative, even if the details don't match up. And I could imagine that kind of context working out. It would be weird, but there you have it. And it was a very, very, very close game. The tension was very high because, again, you know, my goals were modest as the opposition, but the tools that I had at my disposal were even more modest. It was very intriguing in that sense. Votes for Women is a real winner. It's been getting praises everywhere, I think deservedly so. The reprint is up on crowdfunding, so if you want your copy, you can go get one. And I highly recommend it. The rules barrier is probably the lowest of any quality historically driven CDG that I've experienced this side of Watergate. Watergate was, I think, comparably approachable in terms of rules load. A lot of people recommend 1960, The Making of a President. I'm not a huge fan of that game for a variety of reasons, but I really think that if you want to show someone what historical games can do or what board games can do generally, I think Votes for Women is a very, very approachable game for a lot of non-hobbyists, and it's a great way to show people what the hobby can look like. More on that later. I also got to play The Gods Will Have Blood, which is something I've been looking forward to very, very much. The Gods Will Have Blood is adapted from a 1912 novel of the same name, originally written by Anatole France. The original original title is Les Dieux ont Soif, which strictly, literally translated means the gods are thirsty, which is a warning sign, actually, I once saw outside a swan preserve after Zeus had been noticed in the area. It is about a man named Évariste Gamelin, who's a local magistrate, who basically just starts executing a whole bunch of people because it's the terror, and that's what you do in the French Revolution. I'm a sucker for any game about the French Revolution. And The Gods Will Have Blood is, it's actually very reminiscent of a lot of one-player RPGs because it's effectively selling you about a narrative about very focused decision points. And very frequently, the game is out of your control. Like, what you do is you read a blurb about who an individual is and what they've been accused of, and you decide whether or not you want to execute them or exonerate them. and then you pull a couple cubes from a bag. And the cubes might tell you, oh no, you don't get to do what you wanted to do. They're getting executed. It's theoretically possible that on occasion you might want to execute somebody and you're forced to exonerate them. This has not been my experience in the course of the Gods Will Have Blood. Because one of the things that the Gods Will Have Blood shows, or models at least in its evocation, is that vengeance breeds vengeance. There's this notion of momentum. Most of the time after you execute somebody, you just keep adding more murder cubes into the bag, which makes perfect sense. But the goal of your goal in the game, as Évariste Gamelin in The Gods Will Have Blood, is to get enough credibility within the Jacobin party. You don't get credibility amongst the Jacobins by being nice. So there's this constant tension of trying to kill enough people, feed enough people to the machine without being consumed by that machine. And that, I think, despite the fact that this is very, very much situated in a very particular time in a very particular place, namely, you know, 1792 France, it's evocative of a lot of the challenges of bureaucracy, of big machine politics, of what it is to be somebody who wields power, but at the end of the day might be wielded by the power rather than the other way around. And I thoroughly enjoyed my couple of experiences. I would not describe it as particularly decision heavy, but I did find the tension. I internalized the tension in a way that a quality narrative game can. And so I thought that the Gods Will Have Blood was very, very evocative of some of these issues about power and compromise. And people who've heard me talk specifically about role-playing games, I really like stories about power and compromise. I really like stories where your personal priorities are at odds with your general principle. And I really like stories about people who are in the face of an unfeeling system and having to navigate that system. The designer, Dan Bullock, has analogized the Gods Will Have Blood to exploring some of the same themes as the very popular indie PC game Papers, Please. And I actually found this more moving than Papers, Please, for what it's worth, because I just liked the setting so much more, and I didn't think that the, bereft of its sci-fi trappings, or its sort of everywhere and nowhere trappings of Papers, Please, I actually felt that the Gods Will Have Blood was even more successful. Now, I did pay for my copy, but it was assembled for me as a favor by the designer, so I'm just going to call it a review copy anyway. And it was a great one-player experience. It told a story. I internalized the tensions. I wouldn't pull out of again if I was looking for quality strategic decision making, but I would absolutely pull it out again to experience that narrative again, to see other people, because the couple times that I played, I lost relatively quickly. So I have not seen even a majority of the cards, and even if I had, I probably wouldn't remember the specific details. And the game's not really about that. It's not for min-maxing, suffice to say. But there's enough grist there to make you feel like your decisions have weight, and that is what you were looking for. So that's The Gods Will Have Blood, published this year, designed by Dan Bullock.
So we just got through the holidays, Mark, and holidays means families come over, in-laws come over, and they want to play games. They see games, and they say, oh, is that like Cards of versus Humanity? And I sigh, and I don't say anything. So, we played that, and it was great. It was a great drinking game. Everyone had fun. Cards Against Humanity is fantastic. And then I say, well, let me show you this game called Green Team Wins.
Here. All right? Here, here.
And so we had a 9, a 10, an 11-year-old, and their parents, and my wife and I.
Wait. You played Cards Against Humanity with a 9-year-old first? Okay. I just want to make sure I understood the narrative.
I said, here's Green Team Wins.
Right.
We were playing Green Team Wins. It was a great hit with everyone. Kids were learning how to spell and write and learning what high school was going to be like. That right answers don't matter. That you better get on board with the majority. Or
on the topic of being ground up in a system. Yeah.
Just so. And so that was a great hit. This is Green Team Wins. It was designed by Nathan Thornton and put out by 20th Century Games. Make sure you get the 20th Century Game edition, because that's the edition of the Green Team.
Well, in that it supports 7 to 12 players instead of the
Orange Team version. Yes.
The Orange Team version, which only goes up to 6. I have the Orange Team version. It's very sad.
All right. And then the next night. So the next night was just adults. It was another function. And so I had brought 3 games.
High class function.
Music's pumping.
No, Young MC. You're not a fan of Young MC.
Okay. I was trying to think of a line that would fit what I was about to say. But
well, the only thing to say is bust a move.
Bust a move. We did. I busted out. First, I busted out fun facts.
Well, if you want it, baby, you've got it.
It's true.
Okay, this needs to stop. I'm sorry. This is my fault. I've unleashed this this scourge onto just the podcast.
All right. Fun facts. So the first question mark was, so we got, you got this score in the first round. How do I track my score? So this this notion of a cooperative game, right? You know, well, which is, you know, is very new to some people, right?
Sure.
Not many games.
And it's unfortunate because a lot of non-hobbyists don't want to pursue hobby games because they don't want to, they don't like being hyper-competitive, or they don't really care about winning or losing, when the great joy of hobby gaming is that there's so many excellent co-ops.
It's true. So Fun Facts was a big hit as well. So I decided to bring out Just One right after. Just One was a huge hit. And then, unfortunately, there was a dud. I thought everything was going so great. So Clover is definitely the next one.
Ooh, okay.
To bring out.
Yeah.
Right? Because we have word association going on.
Yep.
And then it was just, it was that step too far. It was
that
finding one word that connects two words together. Not that it's difficult. It's just that it's out of the wheelhouse suddenly, right?
Sure.
You know, people that are into hobby games lately have been doing a lot of code names and games like that. So it's just like second nature to them. They understand the notion. But unfortunately, it was a bridge too far. So Clover was dud. We immediately went back to Just One and just played that for the rest of the night because it was a huge, lots of questions about where do I get this? You know, is it on Amazon? Blah, blah. Many copies were ordered. That is Just One. Just One is designed by Ludwig Rudi and Bruno Salter and put out by Repo Production. This was a Repo Production night, by the way. Fun Facts was designed by Casper Lapp, our one of our new favorite designers, also published by Repo Production. And So Clover is designed by Francois Romain and published by, you guessed it, Repo Productions. They just hit after hit from them for party games lately.
I agree. On the topic of party games, although this is not a party you want to be invited to, we played Door of the Lesser Houses, which is the design by Jenna Felly of Devious Weasel Games. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. And it is my favorite Take That card game, despite the fact that it doesn't really look like a Take That card game, in that more or less the only thing you do on your turn is take points from somebody. Effectively, you have a hand of cards, and they come in different suits, and basically the different suits are take a point away from Huey, take a point away from Dewey, take a point away from Walker, take a point away from Sidewinder. That's what they say. They don't actually say that, but that's effectively what they say. Now, this was live streamed with a full rules explanation because we'd actually had this request from a number of Patreon backers, some commissioners who wanted us to do this. It was long overdue. I apologize for the delay. And a great time was had by all. Huey in particular had been waiting to play this game again for years. And it's one of those cases where through a subtle application of proper theming and proper mechanisms, very much like Cosmic Frog, another design from Jenna Felly, it is almost impossible to take anything too personally. Because in a lot of Take That card games, or even a lot of board games where there's direct targeting of other players, it's very easy for some people, mentioning no marks in particular, to take things more personally than they ought to. Or to get bent out of shape because you feel someone's played inappropriately or made a bad play at your expense or what have you. Look, I'm not defending this. This is a bad trait. But a lot of people have it, and they come by it honestly. Door of the Lesser Houses, I cannot remember any time anyone having a particularly bad feeling about it. Because it's the nature of the game, and because of the theming and the presentation and everything, you just fall into it naturally. And I'm a big, big fan of Door of the Lesser Houses. This is a redevelopment of a game called Bemused. I prefer the theming to Bemused, but I think mechanically Door of the Lesser Houses is a little cleaner. In part because Bemused has this weird notion of, well, first of all, the theming is very, very grim. It's about driving people to death. And it's a little more complicated to figure out what happens when you're dead and you don't really come back. Whereas Door of the Lesser Houses is a little more dynamic and you can come back from being an outcast house.
Apparently there's going to be a novel coming out soon.
Yes, I was going to...
I'm sorry, I did take it.
That's a spoiler for the news, Walker.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You have to keep listeners on the edge of their seats.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, absolutely. This is a full universe that Jenna Felly has been sketching out for several years. And so that is Door of the Lesser Houses, a great time had by all. And there was a conversation afterwards about how somebody who was there, my friend Josephus, who had some, it wasn't really his style of game, didn't really like what he felt to be a certain degree of arbitrariness, but I was able to just lay it out afterwards, like, no, look, there are a couple of inflection points over the course of Door of the Lesser Houses where this was a misplay I did, this was a misplay you did, and had we not done those things, other things would have happened, and you know, you can sketch it out.
Yeah, it does seem odd when on the surface, it just looks like you're just playing drain the best card out of your hand. It's like, well, these are the cards I have, so obviously I'm just going to do this. But you really need to look around the table and you need to keep a balance.
Absolutely.
Because if you let one person get away, they can control the table, but if you let them get too far ahead, they're going to end the game and there's no way you can get back. So you're trying to keep this constant level. And like you said, it's always take that. So you shouldn't take it personally, because even things that help you is usually taking a card that's hurting you and you're usually just giving it to somebody else. You're not really, there's a couple things that just flip it over, but usually you're siphoning it off to somebody else.
Absolutely.
And
it's about power. It's about power and tempo. And I've seen lots of different games erupt in very, very different game states. And one of the things about Dwarves of the Lesser Houses, and this is true of the Resistance as well, very different games, but a game of the Resistance crafts its own internal logic that seems ineluctable and inescapable and kind of obvious. But then when you play your next game, an entirely different logic emerges. Dwarves of the Lesser Houses is the same way. I've seen lots of games where you get a whole bunch of outcast houses right away, and the game spirals not out of control, but to its conclusion by virtue of that. In this game we played recently, there weren't any outcast houses for a very long time, and then there was one, but then they came back, and so it was mostly just houses withstanding. Anyway, lots of dynamism in the gameplay, which is exactly what you want, a game about deal-making, about temporary alliances, marriages of convenience. Massive fan of Dwarves of the Lesser
Houses. Yeah, that's why I like the fact that, I don't want to say it is a little surface, more mechanical than it is mathy, like it is for the other games. So that allows a little bit more not so much storytelling, but role-playing and deal-making.
Absolutely, it's more freewheeling, yes.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So, and much like Josephus, that type of game is not for me, but if we are to play it, Dwarves of the Lesser Houses is definitely a game that I would play. And that is by Devious Weasel Games. And right after that, we played a shenanigans game of No Thanks.
are there any other kinds?
Where obviously the deck was stacked and it was foolish. Someone cheated.
I don't know what I think about No Thanks. I really don't. I can't tell if it's incredibly brilliant or too superficial for my tastes. It could be both.
I think for the time it takes to play.
Yes.
And the ease of the teach and getting it going, I think it's a fantastic game. There was some weird dealings in this particular game because it was a brand new game, and I think some of the cards might have been, you know, stuck together.
Yeah,
maybe.
It was a little weird like that. The parts of No Thanks that I really, really love are looking at that card that's good for you. You know, you're sitting on the 13 and the 12 comes up, and finding out how far you can push the table.
Yeah.
Because that reminds me of the same kind of push-your-luck dynamic that's not uncommon in games like Raw.
And Skull.
And I really like push-your-luck when done well. And I think that element of push-your-luck in No Thanks is borderline brilliant. The part that I like less is how much resolves around which of the seven cards are out of the game to begin with. Again, I don't take No Thanks super seriously in terms of a competitive aspect, but it does just, I don't care how long the game is, but if you're going to spend 15 to 20 minutes on the game and all elements of push your luck are drained of any tension because the wrong cards are out of the deck, I've had a couple of sessions of No Thanks like that I found unsatisfying. But when it's firing well and when it's operating as intended, No Thanks is marvelous.
Agreed. And that is No Thanks, designed by Thorsten Grimler. And this particular version is put out by Amigo. It had like neat little phrases on the cards and stuff that I thought were amazing.
Yeah, the little cards were like negging you or egging you on. It was great.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I got to play a game I've been meaning to try for quite some time ever since it was announced. And this is Leonardo da Vinci's Codex Leicester. So, fun fact, the Codex Leicester is the most expensive book in the history of human civilization. It is an assembly of a bunch of Leonardo da Vinci's sketches of weird inventions, like his ornithopter and his bizarre tank. It was purchased for upwards of $20 million by Bill Gates, actually, when it was auctioned off. And it's called the Codex Leicester, not because Leonardo da Vinci ever went to Leicester, but that just happens to be where it was assembled in the 18th century. So that's why it's called the Codex Leicester. This is a redevelopment of a game published in 2006 called Leonardo da Vinci. And for those of you that can remember back to the antiquated times of 2006, back before there was any recorded history, Leonardo da Vinci was a worker placement game that was one of the first to really riff on worker placement in a really interesting way. Those were the heady days of Agricola has just been released. a bunch of people are experimenting with worker placement, sometimes really well, sometimes really badly. And I really liked Leonardo da Vinci's core worker placement conceit, which is preserved entirely in the reprint by Dice Tree Games. And that is, when you send workers to a location, you can send any number you wish. And then when it comes time to resolve that location, whoever has the most workers there, ties broken by whoever got there first, so there's still a timing pressure, gets to do the thing for free. And then the next highest person gets to do it by paying victory points. And then so on and so forth, with escalating prices. So
before, I just wanted to make sure. And then you get to cycle around again to the beginning.
Precisely. So if you're there alone, you can do the action several times by paying a whole bunch of points for it. If you're there with two other people and the second person can't afford or doesn't want to do it for the expensive version, you might get to do it again and again as well. Anyway, there's lots of different dynamics about not being able to get there first or not caring about whether you get there first, despite the fact that money is points and points are very, very, very tight. Ultimately, then it boils down to recipe fulfillment, but the recipes tend to be very, very simple in their requirements. In terms of materials, like this needs two materials. But the timing issues, again, and this is one of the innovations of the Codex Lester version, the timing considerations are rather pointed because whoever finishes the work first gets benefits, but other people may have been forced to declare that they're working on the same thing. Now, they'll still get points, and they'll still get some benefits, but fewer benefits. That, and because this is a Euro game being redeveloped in the 2020s, it has a track where it didn't have a track before, and a couple of other innovations to make it cleaner, which I very, very much appreciate. I've always enjoyed Leonardo da Vinci. The original version, I thought, had a couple of problems with setup that were a little unfortunate. Just didn't make me want to pull down the game over and over, but I very, very much like the changes in Codex Lester, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say about it, Walker.
Yeah, this is by far one of my favorite games I've played this year.
Great.
Yeah, it is. It is so good. Like, there's this chart, like Mark already talked about, in the center of the table because it pertains to all the major worker placement spots where you cycle the first person's free, then three gold, then four gold.
It's actually 2, 3, 4.
2, 3, 4. And then there's a bunch of sort of resource spaces. And the key spaces to go get so busy that you can sort of offshoot off and you're usually going to be the only person in these resource things. And just that dynamic of just sort of having those free spaces out there. It's like, oh, well, they're already there, so I'm not going to bother because I don't want to pay anything. I just want to be the first one there to get free. And then there's these blueprints cycling along the bottom. And then you have this interesting sort of personal board where you're making these workshops. And then you're throwing workers in there as well, and you're generating these work points, which will move your timeline because certain inventions take so long to build. And then it's like, okay, well, I have enough workers and I have some automatons in there and I generate 8 work and I can get this done this turn. And there's so many different timing considerations. Very much enjoyed this game. Can't wait to get it back to the table.
I'm glad you appreciate it. It was really one of those interesting cases of game development because, again, it came out during this early rush of worker placement games, and now it's been retooled with some more modern concessions. Now, I joke that there's a track. There's not really a track. It's just you get various benefits as you accomplish various milestones that everyone has. It's represented in a track form, but it's not the conventional throw resources to track issue.
And they're so useful down that track. Everyone is so intricate and yep, beneficial. You just don't know which one you want to take first. Oh, so good.
Yeah, it's really well done. It was well done to begin with, and I really think that the redevelopment, in large part by Cheng Hoon Beck of Dice Tree Games, has been for the good. This was originally designed by the Italian design collective called as Architocca, and this was their first published design that I noticed. This is Flaminia Bersini, Virginio Gili, Stefano Luperto, and Antonio Tinto, and as I say, Dice Tree Games, which is a Korean outfit redeveloped by Cheng Hoon Beck. And I've been a big fan of Dice Tree Games ever since they did a lavish reproduction of Winner's Circle with painted horses and metal coins and such. Very expensive to import, not super, super accessible. I passed on the reprint of Raw because it looked a little gaudy for my tastes, which is nonetheless appropriate. Like, we have this notion of historical artifacts being sort of austere and sepia toned, but in point of fact, they tended to be garishly colored. I mean, the Elgin marbles are a great example. Like, we have this idea that they were, you know, white and stark. It's like, no, they were painted up more or less like drag queens when they were originally displayed. And anyway, setting that aside, I'm a fan of Dice Tree Games, and I like trying them when I get access to them.
Now, unfortunately, the production is not doing any favors because I sort of dreaded playing this game. It's got the usual brown, beige,
On the topic of sepia, yeah.
And then the name, right? Leonard Codex Lester.
Yeah.
And then it's just not doing itself any favors, right? It comes off as very dry. And I think they might be losing an audience, unfortunately, but just give it a try. Fantastic game. All right. So I talked about things that we streamed. We did 2 weeks. We've been away for a week because of the holidays. We did the Tiny Epic Crime. We did Door of the Lesser Houses. We did No Thanks. And the last one that I streamed is a game called Road Tripping. It does not have a artist or designer. It only has the publisher, which is Guilt Free Gaming.
Well, credited.
Credited.
It no doubt had artists and designers.
It did. But that I could not find out. And I love this game. I am awful at this game, as you can see in the stream. I did do a little last minute comeback, but still not even close. Warm Boy destroyed all of us because it's just his type of game. And what you will do, you have this nice big metal license plate that has 7 spots for you to put letters or numbers 1 through 9. Or spaces. You can leave spaces because you get extra points if you leave spaces, and extra points if you use numbers instead of letters. Then everyone's going to flip up a card and they're color coded. So everyone says, okay, we're going to do the red one. And it'll have phrases like road trip or freewheeling or hot rod. And then you have to sort of make a license plate with that phrase.
Interesting.
With only the 7 letters and using numbers as trick letters or coming up with phrases. I just love that type of wordplay. I think everyone really much enjoyed it. You have sort of 30 seconds. it's not sit and figure it out. It's, you better get that down on the metal or else you're out.
And then do people have to guess what the word you're trying to clue in just out of context, or do you have to match it? Do they match it to cards?
No, what happens is same thing with the 30 seconds. We start with the first player. They flip theirs up. Everyone tries to guess what it is. And the first person to guess it will get the same points as the person that wrote it.
I see. But again, this is out of context. Sorry. It's not from a list. You're not trying to match. No. So Clover, you're matching cards to clues.
Yeah, no, no.
Oh my goodness.
Idea. Yeah, no. You have no idea.
I would end with a score of 0.0 points.
It was great. definitely, if you have just a second, check out the stream. Super fun. It is called Road Tripping by Guilt Free Gaming.
Finally for me, I finally got to try Star Trek Away Missions. This is something that has been on my radar for some time, particularly because a number of reviewers that I trust, like Charlie Thiel, have identified it as being very, very similar to Warhammer Underworlds. And we're still very, very big fans of the mechanisms of Warhammer Underworlds, but it's kind of gotten into a bloated meta state where we don't really want to engage in deck construction anymore.
What, Games Workshop? Game got out of control
and
bloated and they tried to siphon money out of every everyone was shocked.
Star Trek Away Missions is in some ways it's actually genuinely fascinating because I've often wondered in the back of my head, what would a skirmish miniatures game look like if you didn't actually spend much time fighting? And the answer is you end up with Star Trek Away Missions, and sometimes this is okay. So I've heard reports that, especially with some of the other add-on expansion packs, that sometimes people just never trespass into each other's territory, and it devolves into a pseudo game of multiplayer solitaire, which is fascinating. I don't know that I'd want to play it that way. Our game had very, very, very little combat, and I think that was probably a good minimum value. Basically, what happened was I was playing the Federation, and I eventually looked down at my objectives and says, do I have a good reason not to send Worf to go try to cut people's heads off with a Batleth? And the answer was no. I did not have a good reason not to send Worf to try to go cut people's
heads off. He's a good candidate for that.
Well, I thought that today was a good day to die. And so I sent him out, and so there was a very, very little amount of combat. And I kind of appreciated that quantity, especially because I had some objectives that required me to, kick some ass and take some names. And I don't know if I'd appreciate the setup if there was no combat involved, because essentially what happens is you have these objectives that say, go pass a check at a certain kind of space. And you look down on the map and say, okay, well, what's the most efficient way that I can get somebody in that place to then go pass a check? So there's one interesting aspect of Star Trek Away Missions. And in theory, I might be interested in seeing how this shakes out with different teams. In practice, though, I'm not, because in the starter set, it's the aforementioned Federation against the Borg. And another thing that has been pointed out by a number of reviewers, again, Charlie Thiel pointed this out, Dan Thoreau pointed this out, the balance in the base game is non-existent. It really looks like the Borg have no chance at all of being competitive against the Federation with the indicated starter decks. And as we've said many, many times in the context of this podcast, we're not super competitive, but if it's clear that you just can't get anything done by virtue of built-in asymmetry, that doesn't lead to a whole lot of engagement. And number two, you only have one chance to make a good first impression. If your intro scenario is garbage, if your intro scenario is highly unbalanced, it's not going to make me look into either engaging in deck construction, trying to make a finely crafted deck, or theory crafting how to make a more balanced starter set of starter decks, much less buying expansion packs and seeing how other factions might work. This is the inverse of the suicide mission problem. Space Hulk, one of the reasons why Space Hulk is such a brilliant game is that in editions 1 through 3, the first mission is a banger. And
yeah.
So if the second or third missions aren't to your taste, you know that the system works and is amazing.
It's true.
That having been said, the balance isn't very good in Space Hulk, but whatever, it tells a story. In the context of Star Trek Away missions, the balance didn't feel satisfying from a tense perspective. I felt bad for Walker because he didn't have a chance. It didn't make me feel, ooh, I'm doing something so heroic. Nah.
I wouldn't mind trying it again. We do have another faction coming. We have some Klingons coming. And
do we?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know me.
Garon says, Happy New Year?
Exactly.
I do love me some Garon. Garon memes are the best.
And I'm thinking that they're going to have some actual combat missions, which
I imagine.
I'll give you some context because it is so much like Underworlds that it's kind of criminal. you have a deck that is full of equipment and things that will help your units do the things that they do. And you have another deck that is the missions that you have to get in order to score victory points. The game will last 3 turns no matter what, and you try to score as many victory points as you can. Now, with the generic rules load of how the game works, and then the additional rules load of how my faction worked, there was some sort of, you know, key interactions that I missed that I might have jumped on earlier that might have, I don't think would have changed.
But sure.
Would might have been a little bit closer.
Okay. All right. But yeah, I'll try it again. If you want, I would happily try the Federation against the Klingons. It would certainly show what the system looks like when there's more fighting, and it would potentially show if the faction balance is universally as problematic as the base game would indicate. But it at least, I will say this, and this was again pointed out by Dan Thoreau, it does Star Trek better than a lot of other Star Trek games.
I was about to follow up with that. If you are a Star Trek fan, it has all the throwbacks that you want. It has the turbo lifts, it has, you know, the headquarters, the
sick bay,
sick
you've
bay
got the command sections and all this.
Yeah,
the bridge
is what I was trying to say.
Right. And it most Star Trek games tend to fall into, well, how are we going to do a different version of Fighty? And look, most Star Trek wasn't about combat. Sorry, I haven't seen Star Trek Discovery, so I can't comment on that. But this is one of the ways in which I felt the Star Trek retheming of Mage Knight was actually pretty good, because you had all these non-combat things to do. Granted, it was mostly similar to combat with a different kind of paint, but at least they were trying to make a gesture towards it. So similarly, in the context of away missions, you're at least doing a lot of non-combat objectives. You know, it's like your job is to go fiddle with the engineering station. That's a thing that happens all the time in Star Trek. When it's trying to be an action franchise, I don't know that, certainly not with the Next Generation cast and crew. That was not one of some of the highlight reels of Star Trek. So at least it gets that right. I will give it that much.
I don't know. Stepping over chairs is pretty action packed.
Yeah, we made a lot of jokes at Riker's expense. So those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break while we go pay some bills.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Now onto the news and why it doesn't matter.
We like Sorry We Are French. Well, they put out Iki, which is a great game. I looked over a bunch of other stuff. I didn't see anything that like super stood out, but they're coming out with the new Fabio Lupiano and Nestore Mangione game. It's going to be called Shackleton Base, A Journey to the Moon. Looks very interesting. Not much information on it. Love those two designers. Love the publisher. Looking forward to it coming out soon.
Solid crew. Many of you have noticed that there was a profile of Annabelle Holland, game designer and game publisher extraordinaire, in The New Yorker. And it is called The Personal and Political Art of Board Game Design. It's very interesting. A lot of it is going to be old hat to hobbyists, but they did manage to reach out and talk to a lot of really, really interesting people. I mean, foremost among them, Annabelle Holland, who's a fascinating individual. And so learning more about her design process, listening to a good writer have their mind crowbarred open as to what hobbyist games could look like. Interesting stuff. A link to it is in the episode notes.
Zombie Sniper.
Is this a zombie who's a sniper?
Enough said. No,
that's or is it. This a sniper who shoot? All right.
That's it. Zombie Sniper. That's all you get.
That's all I'm getting?
Yep.
Okay.
That's all you need.
Is it?
Yeah.
I can think of needs that I have that are not satisfied by Zombie Sniper.
I don't know.
Apparently that's all we're getting. Zombie Sniper. So, more Jennifelli news. Walker spoiled some of this already because he has no notion of maintaining suspense. Under her name, Jenna Kincaid, she's going to be publishing her first novel called Serpent Ascending. It is going to be in the universe of Dwyer the Lesser Houses. This is slated, according to her announcement, to be published sometime in March or April of this year. I say this year because it is 2024. And also, she has posted on social media the cover art of her upcoming card game, Murray the A-Hole Frog. This is a game designed by a trans game designer, published by a trans game publisher, and the art has been done by a trans artist, and I have played pre-production versions of Murray the A-Hole Frog. I haven't played the final production rules yet, so I'm not in a position to comment, but I have to say that Murray the A-Hole Frog, I think that Jenna is really cornering the market on frog-based excellence, and I think that this is a motif that she should continue to explore.
She set a high bar.
Yeah, oh yeah, she set a high bar for frogs, 2 miles high tall.
Yep.
But Murray the A-Hole Frog, I think, is definitely exploring a new avenue for frog representation in board games. And so I congratulate her. And, you know, if she's found her idiom, then, I mean, she already had an idiom. Devious Weasel games don't really feel like a lot of other kinds of games as a rule. So I'm looking forward to Murray the A-Hole Frog. Congratulations to Jennifelli's upcoming pursuits, both board game and otherwise.
All right, Mark, lastly from me, you and I both like quirky little games, and I think you're going to love this one. So picture it. We're trying to steal gems.
Okay.
And money. And there's sort of like a maze. And you're using a dry erase marker and you're working your way through the maze. You have red glasses on, so only you can see the red laser beams. I have blue glasses on, so I only can see the blue ones.
Okay.
And I'm talking to you and I'm trying to get you to go through this maze through a certain time.
Is this Cooperative Dungeon Scrawlers?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
It's going to be amazing. It is called either Accomplices or Accomplices or Together. I think they're going to go with, for the North American release, it will be called Two, letter Two, Together. This is designed by author Angela and Tony Barala and Julius Meshud, and it's going to be put out by Old Chap Editions.
I'm there.
I knew you would be.
So Envelopes of Cash is a marvelous satire of unpaid labor. Sorry, I meant student athletes of the NCAA. And we very much enjoyed the prototype version that we got to play. The published version hit my doorstep last week. I haven't had a chance to play it yet. But it is definitely heavy, which features into the news elements here. Andy Schwartz, the economist who talks about antitrust law, specifically with respect to sports economics, and parenthetically, if I have one recurring gripe about under-regulation in Canada, the United States, despite my various libertarian leanings, it is the unfortunate atrophy of antitrust law in a variety of different venues. But anyway, moving on. Andy Schwartz has published The Financial Reckoning, giving a lot of transparency about the money behind crowdfunding and delivering a game, particularly in the tsunami of weird financial effects of, you know, the past couple of years. There's a link to it in the episode notes. I highly recommend it. It's a very, very, as I say, it's a lot of transparency. We like radical transparency here in So Very Wrong About Games, and in an industry that doesn't tend to publish things about figures or budgets or sales numbers or anything, it's very, very illuminating. And I very much looking forward to trying my copy of Envelopes of Cash at the soonest available opportunity. And then finally, some sad news about upcoming games that I've been very much looking forward to. For a long time, when people have been asking what's coming up in crowdfunding that you're really looking forward to, my answer has been, or at least included, Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition. Unfortunately, due to a mistake, and for what it's worth, I take the publisher at his word due to a mistake, there is a an item in the Epic Items deck called the Banner of Kekistan, which is crypto-fascist imagery. The designer didn't know that it was crypto-fascist imagery when it was originally proposed, and when he was made aware of it, he had intended to remove it from the final published version, but due to an error, it ended up getting published. And look, I have no difficulty believing this to be true. We see misprints from major publishers all the time. We see instances where major publishers put misprints in their errata packs and publish the wrong card backs for entire card decks. So I have no difficulty believing that through good faith error, this managed to creep through. If you have or are acquiring a copy of Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition, I encourage you to follow suit. What I'm going to do when I get my copy, and what a number of people have already declared, I'm going to be burning this card because crypto-fascist imagery has no place in board gaming. I'm going to be going into more detail about this later when we talk about Assault on Doomrock Ultimate Edition when and if we get to play it, and I'm actually going to be publishing a full-length editorial about crypto-fascism in the board gaming hobby as a Patreon-exclusive episode in the coming weeks. So, an unfortunate incident. For what it's worth, I believe it was unintentional. You can see the author/publisher's apology on BoardGameGeek in a thread that quickly went off the rails, but he published a very, very fulsome explanation about what happened and an apology, so you can check it out there. But I would encourage you to skip past a lot of the, let's just say, people asking the wrong question and answering it badly that you see in a lot of those threads. But that's the kind of thing that you find on the internet. Anyway, that is the news and why it doesn't matter. On to our feature game. What's our feature game, Walker?
Arborea.
Arborea was designed by Danny Garcia and published by Alleycat Games this year after successful crowdfunding. Danny Garcia was also the designer of Barcelona, another game that we reviewed this year. It is a 2-5 player game about psychedelic forest monsters. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Arborea?
Well, the water park slide in the spirit world has opened. And boy, are there options. But don't spend too much time on these slides, because while you're having fun in the sun and gallivanting around, monsters are infesting your home realm. But in reality, your friends have laced your RC Cola with LSD. So get ready for a psychedelic trippy ride. All right. So you're putting out different types of workers.
Well done, Walker.
You're putting out different types of workers. You're seeding the board. So you have action efficiency. You're generating resources for the group, for the whole table, and you're figuring out a sideboard spatial puzzle. This is what you're doing in Arborea.
So let's start with the economy, because I think this is the best aspect of Arborea, bar none. And it's really, really well done. There have been a lot of Euros that have some version of pooled common resources that individuals get to draw from. I mean, most recently we talked about Ceres, which is a worker placement game where the pool of workers is largely communal. In practice, what that usually shakes out to is just another draft. Sometimes it's interesting, sometimes it's not interesting, but that's just the nature of drafting. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. And I think that Arborea does a better job of managing this common versus private resource generation better than any other game in recent memory. What happens is if you generate resources on your turn and then spend them, well, that's what happens. You generate the resources and then you spend them. If you generate the resources but then end your turn not having spent them, you get points. And you get more points based on how starved the system was for resources. If you're the first person to generate a whole bunch of water, that could easily be in excess of 10 points, which is not going to win you the game by itself, but is definitely going to make a difference. On the other hand, if you generate the, you know, eighth iteration of coral, you're probably only going to get a point or two. So ideally what you want to do, in the best instance, and this I think is when Arborea really shines, don't worry, there's a twist coming later, I'm not actually a massive fan of Arborea, is you want to generate the resources that you know other people won't be able to spend, and then spend them yourself later, pocketing both the points and the resources themselves. And when the game of Arborea lets you do that and plan around those things, I think it's really something quite compelling.
Agreed. It is my favorite part of the game. It is definitely the hook and what I try to emphasize when I introduce it. So what do you do? How does Arborea work? Well, if you need something, we've got a slide for that. There are four tracks. both with two slides on either side. So that's 40 different slide options on the whole board.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to present it.
All right, so on your turn, you're either going to... So what I'm trying to say is that there's these sort of conveyor belts. So you put your work on a conveyor belt, and they slide along in various points of the game that sort of line you up with one of these slides. And the further you go down these conveyor belts, the better the slides get. So on your turn, you're either putting a worker at the beginning of one of these conveyor belts, or you're sliding the conveyor belt along. And then you can spend spirit to do that again, if you wish, one or the other. Then at any time, whenever a conveyor belt moves, you get to jump off the conveyor belt. Because on every one of your turns, you get to go down a slide. So you sort of, like I said, you want to seed the board. You always want to make sure you have the option of going down a slide. You want to waste a turn not going down a slide. So then you slide, and like you said, you're either going to get a bunch of, you know, resources, or you're going to put out these monsters. Something's going to happen. And then, like you also said, you get to buy a card. As long as you have a card available to buy or to purchase or to put out, and those resources are available. And then you will get the points for the resources you didn't use, and then all of the tracks that you are on will slide up again.
So fundamentally, there's a number of different ways to score points in Arboria. The one that I find most interesting, again, is managing the supply of resources. But at the end of the day, the endgame scoring is going to be very, very conclusive. And not in a surprising or unfortunate way, but it's one of those ways that you can really point to a new player and say the heuristic is the more monsters you have out, the better you're doing. And you can generally not even look at the score track. You can just look at a table and kind of figure out who's going to win the game based on that blunt determination alone.
I think the average end game score is about 50. And then, like, at the end of gameplay.
Right.
And then the end game score could be in upwards of 200.
Yes. Which is to say that those points you get from resources, again, are influential, but probably not going to be determinative. And Arboria is one of those games where getting a monster out in a good location requires a lot of things to fall into place. One of them is, as you said, you need to get the card. Then the resources you need have to be out there, and then they have to stay out there so that you can take advantage of them. Now, maybe you generate themselves, but then you're spending a lot of points to do that, so sometimes that's an interesting trade-off to consider. Then the monster you want has to be out there, and then you have to get the monster before or at a time when other people don't get it, and then you have to be able to place the right kind of monster on the right kind of card. That is the route to success in Arboria. I don't have any problem with that in the abstract. The problem is, and one of the areas where I think Arboria goes from something that really could have been special to merely a, in my estimation, a slightly above average Euro game, is that all of these variables and all of these issues are very time and economy intensive, and, or should I say fragile or susceptible to variance, and you wield precious little control over when and how these various details are going to emerge. Now, by the same token, just in terms of my priors, I don't mind some games where what you're doing is you're riding a sea of chaos and trying to make the best of what's going on. The problem is that when I'm playing Arboria, I feel like these two elements, the need for all these details to be falling in place at the right time, plus the weird elements of bizarre chaos about this track proceeded at lightning pace and now I'm going down whatever water slide I want, versus this other track is moving at a snail's pace, versus my inability to parse which of the 40 different slides I actually want. That's a bit of an exaggeration. You don't actually need to figure out between 40 different ones, but it's a lot more complicated and the game doesn't do you many favors in terms of figuring it out. That tension between the chaos and the order that's required is what makes me feel like when I'm playing Arboria, I'm actually playing something that's far more arbitrary, not necessarily random, but far more arbitrary than I'd like it to be.
Yeah, I can see where that's coming from. I think it's sort of like being able to turn on a dime, making sure that even though the resources aren't there for you to take, that you have something sort of backup that you're going to work on this other thing instead.
Sure.
Type thing. And either A, generate the resources for points instead, or B, just sort of hold on for a turn. On your next turn, the resources more than likely will be there or not.
Well, right, but that's just one element, right?
Yes.
There's the resources, there's the card, the right resources for the right card, for the right monster, for the right placement, for the right time to take the monster, right?
Yes.
And compounding this is the fact that there are all these different slides available. So I think there are two key offenders here in terms of the different slides. One of them is because it's almost nowhere, and one of them because it's almost everywhere. The almost nowhere problem is there are these god gifts. At the end of every water slide, you get to trigger a god gift. And these can be huge. These can give you the kind of flexibility that can turn a nothing turn into a massive combo-tastic turn the way that some Euros do. But in order to do that, you need to get out these god gifts in the first instance.
The sages. I just want to make sure because so people know what we're talking about.
Ah, thank you. Yes, the sages. And there are precisely two places on the water slides where you get to place those out. Now, there's a sea of other effects, right? Card effects and various situational bonuses and one-time shots and other sage effects that let you put out more. But at its core, when people ask the very reasonable question, how do I do this thing? You point to precisely two spots amongst the 40 different water slides and say, there. That's how it's done. That's one example of how much bottlenecking there is in Arboria. The other extreme, and again, it's this juxtaposition between these two extremes that I find often uncomfortable, is what monster do I need when? And generally speaking, you can collapse some of the 40 water slides into smaller ones because, you know, one of the water slide tracks might generate two water, but the next water slide track generates three water. Well, clearly then, that's not really a universe of detail you need to be able to process. That's pretty simple. Just wait in, it'll get better, and decide timing. The problem starts to creep in again, though, when track one on the water slide might generate a certain color of monster, the one you really want. The next one might not generate any monster at all, and then the next one will generate a different monster of a different color. So in practice, what this amounts to, again, in terms of actually playing Arboria, is that, okay, I want a purple monster. I can't even remember what it's called. We call it Terrifying Eevee.
That's the green one.
I'm sorry, that's the green one. Okay, say I want a green monster, we call it the Terrifying Eevee. Or I want the sort of light pink one, which we call the...
Death Frog?
Turnip Spider.
Turnip Spider, yes.
Yes, it's the Turnip Spider. And you look over the board and say, okay, I can get a Turnip Spider here, but not if I wait too long. Here, but only waiting long. And here, different... It's like, okay. And so it's just this, it ends up feeling again like this weird sea of arbitrary things. And what I do when I start being unable to process that level of heuristic, I just start playing Arboria purely opportunistically. And either I get the combos to fall out and I don't even understand why, or they don't.
I'm also wondering if it's because we got sort of locked into a chain of doing the same thing over and over again. It's like we'd create the spot for the monster, we'd get the monster we would need, we'd put the monster where we made the spot for it. I'm wondering if it's possible to sort of just, for the whole beginning of the game, just work on developing your land part. And then at the end of the game, just populate it then. I'm wondering if there is that opportunity to do that, whether you're not always locked into the same sort of, you know, make the spot, get the monster, put the monster in, start again.
It's possible, but I don't know that Arboria really encourages players to think in those terms. Because again, every resource that matters, whether it's a card, whether it's a monster, whether it's the actual bare resources, if you don't grab them, someone else will. And ultimately, that's where a lot of the tension comes from. A lot of the pleasant tensions, like, will I be able to get this out before somebody else snakes it from me? And what that it does is it encourages you to engage in these short-term transactional plans, because I'm not sure that this kind of long-term planning, I'll be able to get it later, is at all wise. And even if it is wise, again, Arboria encourages you not to think that way.
It's true. It could be possible. We did play it. We played it at 3, and then at 2, and then at 5. And I really don't feel as though it shines very well at 5.
Agreed.
The downtime is atrocious. Well, not atrocious. It's not beneficial to the game, that's for sure.
It's manageable. The downtime's manageable, but the chaos is not, I don't think.
The chaos is, yeah, way off the scale. And it sometimes even just kept targeting the same person over and over again. It seemed as though, you know, resources were generated and then used up, and then would get back to that person.
Yep.
And then they couldn't do anything, and then they would generate some or do something else because they could, and then the cycle would begin again. You know, the generate, and then they disappear, and then they would have nothing.
Right.
So not great at 5.
I thought it was its best at 2, honestly.
Best at 2.
Because then what you're able to do, the universe of noise is narrowed enough that you can look over at your opponent and say, are they going to be able to get a card, or do they already have a card that uses these resources, or will they still be around for my next turn? Because when you're playing even with three or four, the possibility of, again, that weird combo that you can't really anticipate for, it's all there. It's all public information. It's not that it's secret. But the thing is, like, oh, I forgot about that weird sage power they set up for last turn, or this strange one-shot token that hasn't been claimed yet that is then going to let them snake the thing. It's like, okay, they're going to be able to use the coral after all, so I better snap it up now. And again, if I think... I think one of the ways that I think Arboria could have been improved for my taste is maybe if there had been one or two fewer game mechanisms going on. Like, for example, there is this currency called Spirit, which, for the life of me, I had difficulty spending fast enough.
And other people had the opposite.
Which is a strange problem. And other people seem to be in holes that they couldn't get out of. And I if I'd had more mental energy left over, again, I was just trying to grapple with the symbols that were going on, and it was often the case... And I was contributing to the downtime of the larger player count games, where I'd be like, why did I put that worker there? Why are they on that water slide? What was I? Oh, I can't even remember what the economic state was when I put them there, such that I thought that I'd want a couple coral generated in the system. Okay, I guess I'm doing this thing now.
Well, I think that sort of showed, because I watched it happen. It was like I was at the beginning of the game. I was hesitant to spend it because I didn't want to go into the hole. And then I watched you spend it almost every turn, yet get it back. And then I immediately started doing the same. And I also
respect Spirit.
Yeah, respect Spirit. I also just stayed at the top. I think it's one of these things where you spend it, you're going to get it back. And if you're hesitant to spend it, then you're just going to remain in the hole.
Yeah. I imagine an alternate version of Arboria, possibly with a couple more hits with the development hammer, or a little bit more simplification, where I wouldn't feel as confused and powerless in a sea of chaos. This isn't even about playing well versus playing poorly. It's just that it's one of those instances where everything has to come together for me to get where I want to go, and whether or not everything is going to come together seems beyond my grasp. And it all just seemed like opportunistic happenstance when I play poorly, and almost dizzyingly incomprehensible when I'm...
Yeah, because it is crazy. Because at the beginning of your turn, you're going to put out a worker. But what type of worker?
Yes.
Because you have three different types of worker. Some are going to move the track faster. Some, yes, when they get to the end of the track, when you get the sage power, they're going to be able to trigger different sage powers because of the type of worker they, mm-hmm, are. And then where to jump off. So there's like so much choices.
And if it were more like, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, more like Tsulkin. Tsulkin, the longer a worker stays on a given path, it just goes up on an almost linear level. There are a couple of exceptions, broadly speaking. But look, if you need food, you go out and they sit on the food, and like if you can leave them there longer, you're going to get more food. That is not how Arboria works. For some things, it works. Like if you want coral into the system, you just wait longer on that track, you're going to generate more coral. But you're going to generate a different kind of monster, possibly with a different kind of trap. It's those corner details that have tremendous ripple effects based on how precise the requirements are for scoring things really, really well. And that's on top of the fact that the spatial puzzle is well done and not to my taste. Like, again, I've talked about this a billion times before. Spatial puzzles aren't my thing. I think it does a reasonably good job of it, though.
I agree. I like the spatial puzzle there because at the end of the game, you're going to score a certain amount of points depending on where the monsters are and the type of terrains around them. And if, you know, they have a water with them, it doubles that. And if they're, you know, in linear lines with other monsters, they get bonus. Lots of things going on. And then on top of all this, there are the season tiles. And that's also going to pressure you to put your worker...
Gotta have those tracks.
They're going to put more tracks. It's also going to pressure you to put your workers in other places as well. So yet another decision on top of that. Because on these tracks, there's special spaces that help you move up these season scoring tiles that are multipliers. And they all have all sorts of different things. Have this type of monster. Have these number of cards. Have this type of
card. They're pretty tracky tracks.
All sorts of different ways. Tons of different options because you're putting them out randomly at the beginning of the game. So more things to figure out. And then there's also the move the sun tracker. This is going to push the end game.
Yes, and the duration of Arboria is determined entirely. The tempo of reaching the end game is determined entirely by how many monsters you generate. And again, generating monsters is kind of like how generating resources. You just put them into the pool and anyone can go get them. Maybe you want to take them, maybe you don't want to take them. And it is so easy to forget.
But luckily, it's easy to sort of check.
I wouldn't say easy.
So you can count.
It's calculable.
It's calculable. You check all the monsters that are in, make sure you see the ones that are, you know, in the holding pen and not in the holding pen and on the player's board. So you can quickly count them all up and make
quickly,
sure.
Huh?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then make sure you've moved that far on the sun tracker.
It is, to my mind, one of those definitionally fiddly elements that is easy to forget. And yes, you can then evaluate. Well, one game, we did a spot check. And we found out that the end game trigger should have happened a couple rounds ago
yes.
because we've gotten careless. This is not ideal. this is to a certain extent solvable by, you know, during the rules explanation, going hyperbolically overboard in terms of emphasizing it. By our last game, every time someone promoted a monster, two or three people would shout it in an obnoxious way, and two or three of those people were me. Son! So that we would just remember to do it properly. Because it's super important and easy to miss.
Exactly. So I feel the symbology overall is very good because there is a lot of it and
yeah.
a lot of it makes sense. You know, they even on the sun track, it even shows you every space that puts out a monster. There's a symbol of the sun to try to remind you to move the sun track.
The iconography is good and transparent. Parsing the board is not.
And then you may or may not like the fact, like I already said, that 75% of the points are going to be calculated at the end. So you're going to have to know if you are the type of person that needs to know what the score is, this might not be the game for you.
But at least, you know, you can quickly glance around the table and see how well people are doing, right? If somebody has three or four monsters out, they're not going to, even if they're very, very well placed, the odds of them being competitive against somebody who's got seven or eight monsters out, slim to nil.
Agreed. Like we've already said, it is a little bit long in the tooth. I think it could be cut down by 10 to 25%. For time length. Never played again with five.
Nope.
It also does come with the Kickstarter. This was a Kickstarter. It does come with an expansion in. We didn't play with any of the bonus stuff, but there's a built-in expansion. There's some Kickstarter modules that will give those, you know, different sage effects and different, you know, tracks on tracks. So there's a lot to like about Aboria, but it's a lot to take in. Man, the color palette is ridiculous. It does look like a psychedelic trip for sure.
I really like the monster design. We gave the monster design, like, I think one of them is canonically Mush Frog. And there's just, they're very inventive looking. They don't look like any sort of established folkloric mythology with which I'm immediately familiar. And they're very compelling in a sort of hideous and vaguely terrifying way. And I think the board is actually, you know, very attractive in terms of psychedelia. And It presents a whole bunch of information relatively clearly. Processing all that information, though, I don't think is sufficiently easy in order to make intelligent decisions. And ultimately, again, that's one of my frustrations with Arborea. Like, all the individual bits I really like, but the problem is, in conjunction, all told, and this tension between this navigating the vicissitudes of a chaotic economy, coupled with the need of everything to align properly in order to make any progress, is not a juxtaposition that I think leads to its best strengths.
It's true, because on a turn, you can slide two slides for free. You can pay to do a third so that you're going down these slides, triggering all these effects. At the end of all of these slides, there is a sage effect that you may or may not have. So that's up to three different sage effects. So there's so much going on and the downtime. And if you're one of these things where it's like, oh, you know, you don't understand what's going on and the next person is triggering all this stuff, it's going to double down on your frustration. I personally love this game. I'm excited to show it to more people and,
I'd be willing to play it with two or three players.
Yes.
Past that, I don't think so. And again, just as sort of an object lesson in sort of a illustration, a paradigmatic example of my frustrations with Arborea, I think the best turn I ever had, it was one where I actually got a card out and placed a monster and I think generated something like 20 points from leftover resources. And after it was over, as I was handing off to the next player, first of all, I thought, oh, I just wasted a whole bunch of people's time because I was going through all this mechanism. But anyway, instead of that, I said, it wasn't egregious. It was not ideal, but it wasn't egregious. But the more problematic aspect was my first reaction after tallying up the points and looking at, you know, having to manage this card and this other monster, I had no idea how I'd done it. I did not know how I'd done it. When I placed all my workers, I certainly had no expectation that that was going to be the ultimate consequence of what I was going to be doing. And that is just an indication that for me, for whatever reason, Arborea is just, as the Emperor of Austria would say, too many notes.
Yeah,
and it just doesn't play to its strength.
I had this exact same thing. In the last turn, I had generated a certain amount of spirit to get me to the top of the track. And then as soon as I ended my turn, I had to look down and says, okay, are you sure you got to the top of the track? And it took me all the way, you know, all the way around the table for it to get back to me.
Yeah.
And I realized, oh yeah, wait, on the back of this card, it gave me that one spirit that I couldn't calculate. And yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. Which, it's unfortunate. Like, when, especially when you compare it to lots of games that are more mechanically complex, like to your average splatter, even to a lot of Mind Clash games, right? You know, I think of even the Mind Clash games that I'm not a massive fan of, like Tricarion. Tricarion is one of those Euros where everything has to be, all your ducks have to line up in a row in order to get anywhere. Leonardo da Vinci is actually a little bit like that too. You need all your workers to work together, and you need the specific resources to get everything together. The thing is, though, you can look at the board, look at your resources, and easily parse whether or not you're going to be able to do that.
In those games, everything has its own little sort of phase and timing and area to do that. In Arboria, unfortunately, it's just everywhere.
And they're not married, and they're not married to an economy that is fundamentally chaotic.
Yes.
Which, unfortunately, the economy has to be chaotic for it to work, for it to be so interesting in terms of being able to trade off the resources that you generate for points or actual resources. So if they could, if the designer could, I think this is much more interesting than Barcelona, for what it's worth. Barcelona also was, you know, a lot of combo-tastic elements, but at least in Barcelona, you could figure out what was going on. But in Arboria, it's more interesting. I feel like Danny Garcia's third game might be a real banger, right? Like, he's getting towards something. He's getting there. But to my mind, he hasn't quite got there yet. And that's going to do it for this week. Thanks very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information on our website, sowronggames.com, specifically sowronggames.com/contact. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for having decided to spend some time with us. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.